Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In order of their presentation, they are First National Bank of Seminole versus Sam Cooper and others from Andrews County and the 8th Appellate District. Jeffrey Walker, M.D. and others versus Bertha Gutierrez and others from Dallas County and the 13th Appellate District. And Herman C. Tate versus Structural Wood Components Incorporated from Harris County and the 14th Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. Petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will complete the arguments before lunch, but we'll take a brief recess in between the presentation of each case. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you can purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee. The court is ready to hear arguments from petitioner and First National Bank versus Hooper.
May I please report? Mr. Ted Slavin will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please report, counsel? A fundamental principle of fraudulent transfer law is that preferential transfers are not fraudulent transfers unless the debtor benefits from the arrangement in some way other than the payment of his debt, or the debtor transfers more property than is necessary to pay the debt. This has been a principle.
Maybe fundamental, but is it expressly in the law?
Pardon me?
Is it in the written statute?
It is not in the written statute. Well, it is embodied in the written statute and codified and divided in various provisions of the Act. It has been the law in Texas for over 100 years, and it is still the law today. And you'll find those provisions dissected and divided in the reasonably equivalent value sections of the statute, as well as the good faith provision of the statute.
Well, accepting that is all true, this is the real argument here, whether or not the lien that was transferred was greater in value than the debt that was covered.
Yes, that is one of the issues here, and the good faith of the bank as well.
And so what you have to do is not prove that you couldn't make a fraudulent transfer. You have to prove as a matter of law that taking the lien at the time you did not take an interest in property greater than the value of the debt that the lien was supposed to cover.
That would defeat both the constructive fraud submission and finding in it, and along with the good faith of the transferee, would defeat any actual fraudulent finding by the trial court and the jury.
And in your position, the petitioners need both.
I believe the petitioner.
Bad faith and.
The jury found actual fraud and they found constructive fraud. The actual fraud being an intent to hinder, delay, or defraud a creditor. A defense to that found in 24.009A is a transfer is not avoidable if taken by the transferee in good faith and for reasonably equivalent value. So to defeat that, the bank needs to show both good faith and that it took for reasonably equivalent value. On the constructive fraud, that simply requires the proof of that is an insolvent debtor who transfers the property for less than reasonably equivalent value. So therefore, by finding or showing as a matter of law that reasonably equivalent value is given for this mortgage interest, that defeats the constructive fraud claim. At that point, there is no judgment that can be affirmed other than a judgment in favor of that. In fact, I believe on page 24 of the respondent's brief, the Hoopers have conceded that a creditor must show participation in the fraud by the transferee before an actually fraudulent transfer can go forth. And I think you'll find that on page 24 of the respondent's brief. So in that sense, with that concession, Your Honor, you're correct, that if we are able to show that reasonably equivalent value was given for this mortgage interest, then the case should be reversed in that. That is our position. And in fact, reasonably equivalent value was given. You first need to go to section 24.004A of the statute, which is the statute dealing with value. And the Act defines value when an antecedent or an existing debt is secured by a transaction. That, by definition, is value. Now, the Act does not give us what reasonably equivalent value means under those circumstances. But if we go to the official comment to the Uniform Act, which is the source of this provision, it does provide an answer to that question. If you go to a comment 3 of Section 3 of the Uniform Act, it states, under this Act, a transfer for security is ordinarily for reasonably equivalent value, notwithstanding a discrepancy between the value of the asset transferred and the debt secured, since the amount of the debt is the value of the interest in the asset transferred. So that comment itself equates the mortgage interest or the debt with the value of the asset transferred. And the asset transferred is one of the important issues in this case. What is the asset transferred? It is a mortgage interest in this asset. It is not the entire asset. And that is recognized in the official comment, and it does say ordinarily, and then the comment goes on to explain situations where that may be out of the ordinary. These would include transfers to insiders. The Act specifically does not allow an insider to secure an existing debt as being value, a reasonably equivalent value. So that is one of the situations that is not in existence in this case, which may be out of the ordinary situation.
You only got a mortgage interest in right.
Yes.
Who has the underlying ownership and the chance to do any? The debtor, do anything about? I mean, well, just getting down to actual fact here,
yes,
in terms of keeping this pipeline in working order, who has the right and the means to accomplish that?
The debtor had the right to do that. The debtor owned the property and was not divested of the property until the foreclosure sale. So up until that point in time, it was the debtor's right to deal with his property and the debtor's responsibility to upkeep the property. The bank did not acquire the actual property until it was a successful bidder at the subsequent foreclosure sale. Now, the loan documents that Mr. Thornton signed years before the default judgment was rendered in favor of the respondents in this case, Mr. Thornton, the debtor, signed documents that authorized the bank to require additional security for its loan if it deemed it was necessary, and to require the debtor to come in and sign additional documentation if necessary to properly perfect its security interest in the collateral. The bank secured this $300,000 loan with a UCC financing statement and a security agreement that had attached to it a list of all the assets of the Owego gas gathering system. That attachment came straight from the bill of sale for the assets. What the bank neglected to do, and these are complicated transactions, as the record indicates from the expert, from Mr. Hooper that testified, is they did not get a deed of trust on the easement or the right-of-way where the pipe had been laid across the county and various entities. When the bank was faced with the last resort that all banks want to do is foreclose on something like a pipeline and the responsibilities and potential liabilities that went with it, they discovered they had not gotten a deed of trust. They called Mr. Thornton in under his loan documents and said, "You're required to sign this. We need it to properly protect our security. Otherwise, there's 254,000 feet of pipe that are listed as the equipment and part of the assets that we acquired a lien on, we won't be able to adequately protect without it." So the bank did nothing but do what the loan documents allowed it to do, and that is not a fraudulent transfer.
Does it make a difference that this money was lent to build this pipeline as opposed to, say, sort of a line of credit for the business of, construction out there? And then at some point in the future, the bank decides that it doesn't have enough collateral to cover the loan, and so they go bring him in to give interest in some unrelated property?
No, I don't think that makes a difference.
Then how could a bank ever be subject to the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act if all it ever did was just get a lien on property, irrespective of whether the property's what it loaned the money on or unrelated, just as long as it's ever owned by the debtor? could a bank ever be subject to the
Certainly it could be. If it was facilitating or knowingly participating in a transfer to benefit the debtor in some way other than the satisfaction of his debt, it certainly could. For example, if it were...
Well, it's actual fraud, but you could never have constructive fraud.
You cannot have constructive fraud unless less than reasonably equivalent value is given. Now, there could be a loan transaction, for example, for a lender that is fictitious, that purports to secure more than is actually owed, or something of that nature. And in that instance, if the deed of trust says it secures $300,000 of debt, but actually there is not $300,000 of debt, there may be $100,000 of debt, and it's some sort of fictitious arrangement, then you have less than reasonably equivalent value under those circumstances.
That's actual fraud. The only constructive fraud would be if the bank made a mistake in its paperwork.
That could be actual fraud, but it is also constructive fraud, because understanding constructive fraud, it's an insolvent debtor and then for less than reasonably equivalent value. Now, it's focusing on that arm of the constructive fraud test. So it could be an insolvent debtor who has a deed of trust interest that shows that it's for less than the value. But if it's not an insider, which would also be another exception, and the debt is valid and a mortgage interest is given, and the bank is not participating in any way in an intent to defraud other creditors or to allow the debtor to have some benefit beyond payment of its debt, then that specific scenario does not give rise to fraud on the transfer claim.
If the deed of trust had been the day it was signed, is it true that the Hoopers would have had preference with their judgment lien?
No, it's not.
Why not?
Because the important date is when the deed of trust is filed versus when the abstract of judgment is filed. That perfects the lien. So the deed of trust was filed, and nothing was, of course, backdated on that date, 15 days before the abstract of judgment was filed. So the bank's deed of trust lien was filed prior to the abstract of judgment.
So in terms of creditor preference, it wouldn't have made a difference whether it was backdated or not?
No, it would not. And the date on the front of it is the date of the original note that it secured. The date it was signed and notarized is the actual date and the date it was filed. And there's nothing in the record to indicate there was any attempt to show that had been filed earlier or to show that had been signed at a different time than it was notarized on the document itself. Another issue in the case that we have asserted is the personal judgment that was awarded by the bank. It's our position that is an equitable remedy, and that the law of equity supplements the provisions of the Act, and therefore requires an analysis before that kind of remedy is given against a transferee, especially one that has had no liability findings and no improper conduct findings or anything of that nature, that there be some showing of a knowing participation in the transfer before a money judgment can be awarded, or some other compelling equitable reason leads to that result. No Texas cases have directly addressed that, but we cite a case, the Park Hill case from the Washington Court of Appeals, that essentially holds that very provision. And what the Park Hill case was based on was the supplemental provision of the Act that requires equitable principles to overlay unless they're displaced by the provisions of the Act. The case was not adding any new requirements that weren't already in the Act. And if you review the Act, even the remedy of personal judgment is subject to adjustment as equities require. Equity is in 24.08 as far as the principles of equity applying to the remedy. And of course, the legal remedy in this kind of fraud would be a personal judgment against the debtor. Obviously, that's not anything that's of any value because the debtor may be insolvent. So the Act provides these equitable remedies to address that situation.
Is it true that another panel of the Washington Court of Appeals criticized Parkway Bank?
I'm not aware of that.
That's what their brief said. I'll catch you later.
Was there a bankruptcy? Did the debtor ever take bankruptcy?
In this case, the debtor personally did not take bankruptcy. There was a rollover limited partnership that the debtor was one of the partners that did take bankruptcy. In the middle of all this, although the record is not clear on the interplay with that, it apparently happened sometime before this original loan was made, I believe before 1988. And at that point in time, it apparently affected the repayment of this loan because the loan was being repaid for 20 months. The principal of the loan was dropped from $300,000 to $183,000. And that was from payments under a gas contract that was being serviced by the pipeline. And there's some indication in the record that the default occurred when the bankruptcy trustee in the limited partnership seized some of those receivables or those payments from the gas. So there's some indication of some involvement of it in relation to the default, but the bankruptcy itself took place prior to the loan being made.
My question is, on the fact that Eagle Pacific had on Park Hill, and that's at 934 Pacific, 715.
Yes, and I don't recall, I reviewed that, and I don't specifically recall the criticism that was, I saw that in the briefing, I reviewed the case, but I don't specifically recall what the criticism was or if it was a criticism of that provision.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Please leave the court. Mr. Frank Chandler will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, counsel. As stated, my name is Frank Chandler. I represent Sam Hooper, Mary Beth Hooper, and Hooper and Sons Investment. This case is fairly straightforward. There is a requirement. There are four ways under the Fraudulent Transfer Act in Texas in which to avoid a fraudulent transfer. The first is under 2405A1. It says a transfer made with the actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud any creditor of the debtor. That is actual fraud. The other provisions are constructive fraud provisions. The second provision is 2405A2, which states that if the transfer is made without receiving reasonable equivalent value and the debtor is insolvent at the time of the transfer or becomes insolvent because of the transfer, then that is a fraudulent transfer.
How can a bank that takes a lien interest to the extent of the debt it's owed take an interest that exceeds the value of the debt? Or how can that not be an equivalent value?
It cannot be equivalent value in situations such as the one that's presented in this case. The value of the bank's debt was $202,000. That's what was actually secured by the deed of trust lien that was given on April 15th. The value of the property as of April 15th by the jury's finding is $700,000.
Well, the bank can't take $700,000.
Well, the bank is fully secured and the property is fully encumbered. If a bank or a lender lends money to the purchase of property, it is fully secured in the property and the property becomes fully encumbered. The only way for a bank to get paid, for that lien to be resolved, is either one, the note is paid, or the debt is paid, or the property is sold. Until the property is sold, the equity cushion, what we call the equity cushion, is out there, but it's not available to other creditors because they become secondary lien holders.
But that's true. Let's suppose my house was paid off.
Yes, sir.
And I wanted to get a home equity loan for 5% of the value of the house to take a vacation loan. That any other debt would then be subordinate to that equity. So if I go insolvent, if I get defeated in an election and don't have any income, the bank all of a sudden has violated this statute.
It has not violated the statute in those circumstances, because in those circumstances, we're not dealing with actual intent. In this case, there was clearly a finding of actual intent. The debtor transferred the property to the bank with the intent to hinder, delay, or defraud the creditors. And one of those creditors was Sam and Mary Beth Hooper.
So if they had, if they had, That would be your argument, even if there had already been a security interest executed but not filed. The mere fact that the bank went and filed its security interest after knowing about the Hooper's judgment, that would be a hindering of debt because they would have improved their lien versus the abstract judgment.
Well, it depends on the facts of the case. Every one of these cases is fact-specific. These cases all revolve around the facts of the actual case.
Well, but the fact would be that the bank knows there's this judgment out there for $1 million, and they're going to go file an abstract judgment against any property that's out there. We're sitting here in our office with a lien, with a deed of trust that's been executed, and oh my gosh, we haven't filed it. We've got to get to the courthouse before they do and file it to get our lien in advance of theirs. Otherwise, we might have a subordinated interest, and you'd say that's in defraud of creditors because they hindered the other creditor by the mere act of trying to get their lien ahead of theirs.
No, I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. What I would say is that in that situation, the original loan had this deed of trust. If the bank had taken a deed of trust when the original loan was granted in 1990, and it wasn't to purchase the pipeline, it was to consolidate Mr. Thornton's debts to the bank. If they had taken the deed of trust at that point in time, Mr. Thornton wasn't insolvent, and he wasn't attempting to hinder the layer to fraud his creditors. So the statute really revolves on what is the debtor's intent, not what the transferee's intent is. It's actually what the debtor intended to do.
Where's the evidence of the fraudulent intent? Why is preferring one creditor over another hindering or delaying or defrauding another creditor?
In that situation, what the evidence in this case is that there was less than reasonable clearance value transfer. And that's where that's the crux of the argument.
How do you deal with Official Comment 3 to the Uniform Act, Section 24.004?
I would point the court to Section 3, to read Section 3. The Comment 3 to Section 3 of the Uniform Fraudulent Act says that under this act, that a transfer for security is ordinarily. This wasn't a transfer for security. This was a transfer for foreclosure. The bank attempted to do in two steps what it couldn't do in one step. There's no argument.
What's the difference?
The difference is if I transfer a deed of trust to you for security, what I'm saying is that I have the ability to pay you.
No, this section doesn't even come up to you in solvent. So we're dealing with someone who's insolvent. They transfer a security interest. Everybody knows they're insolvent. They transfer security interest. The cases
seem to require the granting of new consideration on the part of the transferee.
Why, if you're already entitled to it?
In this case, the bank wasn't entitled to it.
You don't think the loan documents gave it the right?
No, Your Honor, I do not think so. This is a
Why
second.
Not?
They had a security interest in specific property on the pipeline. That's clear from the evidence. They then came back and found out that they weren't fully secure, that they had only secured a portion of the pipeline. They then came back in a rush to grab the rest of the pipeline after they had already decided to foreclose. The bank's testimony.
They had a contract that said if we didn't get enough security, you have to give us more.
Yes, Your Honor, you have to give more security.
And that's not.
But in this case, we're saying that granting of security wasn't reasonably equivalent to the amount.
Well, I was just asking, though, did they have the right to ask the debtor to give them that?
Yes, they did have the right to ask the debtor.
Under the original loan paper.
Under the original loan document.
So we go back to set comment three. It specifically says that in these circumstances, the debt's measured by the value of the interest in the asset, not the value of the asset.
Well, if you go further into it, it points to a case where a quitclaim deed was given. A quitclaim deed was given and the court in that case said that that was a fraudulent transfer. If you go on and look at, let me find it. Comment 2 to Section 3 of the Uniform Act. The definition of Section 3 is not exclusive. Value is to be determined in light of the purpose of the Act to protect a debtor's estate from being depleted to the prejudice of the debtor's unsecured creditors. The Comment 3, Section 3, the case is Hartford Association versus Browmaster Company and Jurassic, 254 Michigan 131, 235 Northwest 836. A quitclaim deed given as a mortgage held to be fraudulent to exempt the value of the property transfer that Stevens' indebtedness incurred. Also, comment 3 under Section 4 of the Uniform Act states that unlike the Uniform Project Conveyance Act as originally promulgated, this act does not prescribe different tests when a transfer is made for the purpose of security and when it is intended to be absolute. The premise of this act is when a transfer is for security only, the equity or value of the asset that exceeds the amount of the debt secured remains available to unsecured creditors and thus cannot be regarded as the subject of a fraudulent transfer merely because of the encumbrance resulting from an otherwise valid security transfer.
Yeah, why wasn't the equity cushion, as you call it, available to unsecured creditors here? Someone could have bought this for value at the foreclosure sale.
Because in this case, the bank had decided prior to taking the security interest that they were going to foreclose. There's record,
what difference
evidence
is,
and record.
But that doesn't affect the availability of the equity cushion to unsecured creditors. It's still there. If it's really worth $700,000,
well, we have two problems here, Your Honor. One is the fact that the property in question is a pipeline. As you can see from the record, there were various offers to purchase the pipeline right around the time that the bank took its deed of trust. In each of those offers, the prospective purchasers, asked to have time to do due diligence. Because we're dealing with 28 miles of pipeline, they had to do due diligence to figure out what they were buying and how they were buying it. In this case, the bank took its deed of trust lien and immediately foreclosed on its new deed of trust lien as quickly as it could.
So we've got to construe the act on an asset-by-asset basis depending on what kind of asset it is?
Depending on the asset and depending on the facts.
So if this were a car and they had an equity cushion, if they'd done this with an automobile, you would not have... The act would be construed one way, but since you're saying this is a pipeline and it's harder to sell a pipeline than a car, we've got to construe the act a different way.
I would construe the act a different way because one has a market value that's easily determinable.
Your real concern here is that by the foreclosure, the bank somehow reduced the value of that asset.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's your concern. And so, what did the bank that was not of equivalent value?
The bank took the property, Your Honor. Our position is
that the bank can only take the property to the extent of its debt. Your argument is that by the way they took it, they somehow reduced the value of that asset. How is the bank taking something of not equivalent value if all that happens is that because of foreclosure, the asset totally isn't worth as much as the other creditors think it ought to be worth?
In that situation, what you have is a situation where the bank is attempting to capture the equity. Our belief is the bank was attempting to capture the equity cushion. That is, foreclose, move forward, collect the entire amount of the pipeline, go to foreclosure sale, have a distressed sale of the pipeline, own the pipeline, then turn around and sell it to one of the offerees for the $700,000 to $1.5 million
off. What does the record show about what actually happened?
The record actually shows that the bank had decided to foreclose sometime prior. They were
post
under
foreclosure.
Post foreclosure, at that point, we don't know what happened. All we know is that we filed our lawsuit and they quit maintaining the pipeline. And so,
I'm not clear how they could capture the equity cushion.
Well,
don't they owe it back to the debtor?
No, under their argument, if the bank had foreclosed like it did, paid $242,000 for the pipeline, as it did, it's now purchased an asset for $242,000, which is worth $700,000. That means the bank comes in and gets a $500,000 windfall at the sale. That's our position of how this case
was. That's your theory in the case.
That's our theory in the case.
But you didn't have any proof about what they actually did.
No, Your Honor.
The theory was that that's what they must have intended to do given the speed
given the course of conduct, given the speed at which they acted, given the nature of the fact that there was a judgment 15 days before they took a deed of trust and they immediately signed the deed of trust and immediately began foreclosure.
But you don't know if they still own the pipeline? I mean,
they own the pipeline. They have legal title to the pipeline.
Isn't there a way to challenge the foreclosure sale otherwise than through the Fraudulent Transfer Act? I mean, Can't you contest that the sale was reasonable?
I believe that that's the debtor. The debtor can contest that the sale was reasonable. We have no interest in the farmer.
All right, let me ask you, is this supposed to work like a preference in a bankruptcy proceeding? Let's say the debtor had declared bankruptcy.
Yes, ma'am.
And let's say that this pipeline had been transferred to the bank by deed. I think it's a six-month preference period now. And let's say that 6 months or 5.5 months before the debtor filed bankruptcy, he had deeded the pipeline to the bank. What would the trustee in bankruptcy do to get that property back? I mean, let's say it had sold. The bank had then sold it. I just don't know bankruptcy law, and I won't fault you for that right here. But what would be the value? What would the trustee sue for to get that back into the debtor's estate?
In this circumstance, or in the circumstance you've given, the trustee would file a preferential transfer action with the bankruptcy court. And since the trustee is a super creditor, he has the power to come in and have the court set aside the transfer.
Well, but let's assume that the asset has sold, as it did here.
Yes.
What value would the trustee be seeking to put back into the debtor's estate?
The value of the pipeline at the time of the transfer.
And that's my point. Is the purpose of this Fraudulent Transfer Act to sort of, if the focus is on the insolvency of the debtor, is it in a non-bankruptcy context to protect creditors?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what it's supposed to do. It's to protect creditors from competing creditors who are either insiders or are taking for less than reasonable equivalent value.
Well, if that were true, in every secure transaction where there's an equity cushion, under your saying under this act, all of the unsecured creditors can come in and have that foreclosure set aside, we would be radically changing the law.
No, Your Honor, you wouldn't, because in this case, you're not dealing with a normal course of events.
I thought in response to Justice O'Neill's question, you said this is just a preference like the Bankruptcy Act preference. And the Bankruptcy Act preference doesn't depend on intent or fraudulent or anything else. It's just a strict time thing.
It is a straight time thing, and that's the advantage of the preferential.
So is this that or not?
It is not that.
Okay.
This goes one step further. This protects from fraudulent transfers by insolvent debtors, and it also protects, unlike a trustee, we're not a super creditor. We don't have the powers of the bankruptcy court behind us. The bankruptcy court only deals in time, as you stated. However, in this case, what we're dealing with is actual intent and or deliberate fraud.
Was the abstract judgment filed before the foreclosure?
No, yes, Your Honor, the abstract of judgment was filed.
So would you have not been a claimant? You were not an unsecured creditor at this point, at least for the real estate interest?
Not for the real estate interest, correct.
So you would not have the authority to challenge the foreclosure if it was less than market value, less than the market value, if they attempted to cut out your lien by underbidding the market value of the property? Would you have a claim?
I don't know if I have a claim or not. We have not looked at that section of the law, since it's all fairly new and I don't do a lot of litigation.
I haven't checked it recently, but
my understanding, though, it's the debtor's ability, and it's the debtor's ability to file that suit because he is the one who actually owns the equity cushion.
And certainly you would have, in the priorities of liens, recognizing that you would have had a lower priority under the circumstance here, it might have been in your client's best interest to go in and bid the $250,000, whatever it was due on the loan, and pick up an asset that you thought was worth $700,000.
If we had been aware of the transfer, however, my client lives 1,000 miles away from the county in which all this occurred. And so my client was unaware of the foreclosure, and unaware of the foreclosure sale. We would have gone in. We could have gone in.
I just want to be clear about one thing. You say that the bank had the right to ask for that deed of trust under the original loan document.
Yes, Your Honor.
And yet, are you saying that the execution of that deed itself was the fraudulent transfer? I'm just trying to understand it. If they had the right, then exercising it shouldn't be an issue here, right?
Well, they had the right if he was solvent. This debtor was insolvent. They knew he was insolvent.
But they had the right before he was insolvent.
I believe that they
had. And then he loses it, the bank loses that right once he becomes insolvent.
They must be much more careful about their lending practices after they become insolvent.
But they're still entitled to it legally, is what I'm trying to get to.
Under the case law, they're entitled to it if they give new back.
Why do they have to give new back? That's the part I don't understand. I'll give you, if you'll give me a financing statement and any other security I ask for, I'll give you $300,000. Okay? Here's your financing statement. What else do you want? Well, nothing right now. Okay, here's your $300,000. Okay, now, I've been thinking about it. I want a deed of trust. Now, why do you have to give additional back? That was the original deed.
Because we're dealing with an insolvent debtor. In a normal course of events, if you were not insolvent, there would be no problem with giving additional security.
In fact, the creditor would only be getting, by receiving the deed of trust, he'd only be getting what he bargained for in the first place.
Yes, sir.
But you think because the debtor is insolvent, that changes?
It changes, and it changes it under the statute.
Isn't extension of credit, isn't extending the loan new value?
Yes, that is new value, but there is no evidence and there's no proof. In fact, there's evidence against that.
Where does the statute require that you give new value if you're insolvent?
The statute doesn't require, as far as I can tell, the statute doesn't require, but the case law does. And the case law that we were looking at is Bossier Bank and Trust versus Phelan. Let me see.
But the statute doesn't say one way or another.
The statute doesn't say one way or another. The statute's very straightforward. The statute says you prove actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud, and it becomes... Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
To continue with Justice Owen's question, the statute at 24.004A provides value is given for a transfer or an obligation if, in exchange for the transfer or obligation, property is transferred or an antecedent debt is secured. The statute does not require new value. To the contrary, the statute provides that existing debt is value for purposes of the fraudulent transfer act. And I need to get a little bit into the record evidence here with respect to what happened around the time of the deed of trust was given for foreclosure. You'll see in the record that after the deed of trust was given, Mr. Thornton received an offer from Real Papers, contingent on it doing its due diligence, to pay up to $700,000 for the pipeline. The letter specifically asked for 7 days of due diligence, which expired on April 30th. After doing our due diligence, as all the floated offers to make an offer had done before it, they never showed up, they never put out any escrow money. They decided upon their due diligence that they did not want to purchase this pipeline, certainly not want to purchase it for the amount of that offer. 6 days after that letter, which was also signed off on by the bank, to indicate the bank was still trying to allow Thornton to sell this thing, the bank did not want to foreclose on this pipeline. Banks are very reluctant to foreclose on these kind of things. Banks want to get paid for debt. After that happened, and this was the last of a series of offers that had happened, 6 days later is when they posted the property for foreclosure. So that's the evidence in the record about what happened. That's the only evidence in the record about what happened in connection with the deed of trust and the fact that the bank called them in under its security provision to secure it. How else could the bank secure 254,000 feet of pipe, which I believe is about 48 miles worth of pipe, that is listed specifically in an attachment to its security agreement and in an attachment to its financing statement? When that pipe is in the ground, how else can it properly perfect its security interest without requiring an additional deed of trust document? And that's what the loan documents allowed it to do, and that's what it did. And that is not a fraudulent transfer. Fraudulent transfers, the underlying purpose is to prevent a debtor from placing his assets for his benefit or a family's benefit or for some reason other than the payment of his debt, to abscond with it, to put it away from his creditors. That is not in play in this case. This is simply a case between competing creditors. For example, if Mr. Thornton had known, we don't even have any evidence that this default judgment was ever sent to him, within 2 weeks after it was rendered, 1,000 miles away, wherever he was. So they didn't offer any evidence that the court or that the had sent him notice of this, but assume he had notice of it, and assume he was mad the bank had been hassling him to come in and sign this deed of trust,
And he decided he'd rather the Hoopers get paid rather than him. So he delays until the Hoopers sign or file their abstract on the real estate and becomes a lien in priority over the bank's lien. If our situation was a fraudulent transfer, that situation would be a fraudulent transfer as well. And that simply is not the law. It is not a fraudulent transfer to prefer one creditor over another. The only time that becomes an issue is in a bankruptcy context, and the timing of it is close to the filing of the bankruptcy. The statutes provide trustees with super creditor status to be able to go set those aside and equitably divide that up. That is not the law. That is none of those provisions are in the Fraudulent Transfer Act.
Do you know if only a debtor can bring an action to challenge the reasonableness of the foreclosure, or can another creditor do that?
I do not know the answer to that question. I have not researched that. It seems to me that a junior lien holder, should have some sort of standing to make that claim, and I'd be happy to post a submission to provide a letter to you on that report. So, good luck.
I'd like to know the answer to that.
The other issue in the case that I have not discussed yet, but that is maintained in our brief, are the actual time limit.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court will now take a brief recess.